Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kripko, and I'll be going over 5 recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on. But either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top 5 countdown for the week. At number 5, we have the U.S. extending its special forces operation in Yemen as it seeks to reestablish its toehold on the northern side of the Bab el-Mandab. Reports state that the U.S. will retain its dozen or so troops in southeastern Yemen, where they'll apparently assist their Emirati counterparts in the coastal city of Mukalla. If you remember, I spoke about this port town a month or two ago when the Saudi-led coalition started to liberate it from al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Since then, the terrorists have fled and the town is no longer being used as their regional headquarters. But the threat still remains, and it's uncertain how many fighters simply disguise themselves as city folk and are waiting for another opportunity to retake the town. Even so, a dozen U.S. Special Forces units don't really make much of a difference in the grander scheme of things, and they wouldn't be able to stop the terrorists on their own if a concerted offensive was made against Mukalla. Therefore, it's reasonable to infer that they're deployed to southeastern Yemen for other reasons than their presumed anti-terrorist duties. To tackle the first reason, the Washington Post ran a story in 2014 about how some U.S. military figures called the UAE Little Sparta. And truth be told, it truly is a small power that punches way above its weight in international and military affairs. Now, I'm not endorsing it or saying that I support it, and I'm totally against what it's doing in Yemen, for example. But facts are facts. The country is one of the world's top arms importers and is the only member of the Saudis' multi-dozen country coalition that invaded Yemen and was somewhat able to hold its own, although of course with quite a lot of casualties to go along with it. Again, I'm not endorsing it at all, but what I'm saying is that the U.S. is using its special forces in Yemen to deepen the partnership with the UAE as a strategic alternative to the crumbling Saudi kingdom, which is predicted to have even tougher times ahead in the coming decade. And then there's the fact that U.S. ships are off of the Yemeni coast right now, and they're conducting reconnaissance and likely giving the Saudi-led coalition valuable intelligence to assist with drone, air, and special forces strikes, if not outright doing them on their own for them. Those dozen or so special forces are the plausibly justifiable reason that those ships are in the pivotal Gulf of Aden in the first place. And if the troops were removed, then the excuse for those naval assets to be there in the first place also goes away, which is why it's important to keep such a symbolic presence of soldiers in the war-torn Arab country. So all in all, whichever way the U.S. tries to spin it, its dozen or so special forces aren't being kept in Yemen to fight terrorism, but for 2 very different strategic reasons entirely. The next one up are the tens of thousands of Okinawans who are protesting against the U.S. military occupation of their island and the rampant lawlessness of American troops. There hasn't exactly been a mainstream media blackout because it's just too big to ignore, but they also haven't been following the story like they should. But around 65,000 Okinawans protested last week in the largest demonstration that the island has seen for some time. The locals have always had a tense relationship with the 26,000 or so occupying U.S. troops that continued to be stationed there after the island was formally handed back to Japan in 1972. And in the decades since, the U.S. troops have carried out all sorts of crimes, including murder and rape. Worse still, and going off of allegorical evidence that's easily accessible all across the internet, the U.S. soldiers still actually behave as occupiers, meaning that some of them have a very disrespectful and condescending attitude towards the locals and interact with them quite aggressively and in a very rude fashion. To top it all off, the U.S. base there is a constant irritant for the Okinawans, who are forced to hear planes flying overhead at all hours of the morning, day, and night. So it's little wonder that they eventually had enough when a U.S. Marine was arrested on suspicion of murdering a young woman and dumping her dead body. To put it all into context for you guys, Okinawa is also located in the Ryukyu Island chain, which only became part of Japan in the late 19th century, and the people there feel like they're disproportionately bearing the brunt of the military occupation more so than any other part of the country, especially considering that they had less to do with the World War II era crimes than the 4 main home islands did. On top of that, The U.S. has been in the long, drawn-out, and delayed process of relocating part of its Okinawa facilities to another part of the island in order to appease the angry locals. But now, caught up amidst the new murder controversy and the explosion of protests that it's engendered, people feel like this is the right time for the U.S. military to move out completely and never come back. Now, as much as I'd like to see that happen, and for the islands to be liberated and free from foreign troops raping, killing, and disrespecting the locals, I don't think that the U.S. will withdraw from Okinawa, because after all, not only does it house a substantial portion of the U.S.'s occupying forces in Japan, but it's geostrategically located near the disputed Diaoyu or Senkaku Islands, which are becoming more of a flashpoint between China and Japan with each passing year. It might potentially be forced to draw down some of its forces as a conciliatory concession. But no matter what forthcoming crimes U.S. servicemen, and maybe even one day, service women, commit in Okinawa, Washington isn't ever going to let go of its outpost on the edge of the East China Sea. Third in our countdown are the clashes along the Afghan-Pakistani border and how they presage a return to Western-provoked tensions between the two South Asian states. What ended up happening last week is that both sides exchanged gunfire and four people lost their lives in the skirmish, which ended in a ceasefire and the temporary closing of the border. Afghanistan was upset that Pakistan had been reinforcing its side of the frontier with added security measures as a response to decades of terrorist infiltration, with Kabul officially never recognizing the 1893 British-imposed Durand Line border between them. That unilateral line on the map split the Pashtun ethnic group apart, with there now being more Pashtuns in Pakistan than there are in Afghanistan, despite them being the largest plurality in the latter. I could talk for a while about the problems that this created and how easily exploitable they are by outside powers for divide and rule purposes. And just know that the Durand Line is Afghanistan's main state-to-state international dispute, chiefly because some feel that it unfairly deprived the country of its maritime access to the Arabian Sea through Balochistan, a region which is now divided between Afghanistan, Pakistan, and also Iran. But why now? And why is this over 100-year-old spat coming back to the surface at the moment when the Afghan government barely even exists and can hardly exercise any sovereignty over its own territory? Well, China. That's why. Beijing is investing $46 billion in the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor that will run through the Pashtun-populated areas and Balochistan. And the U.S. is dead set against seeing its chief economic rival gaining unhindered and unobstructed access to the Indian Sea via Pakistan. While non-state actors such as the Pakistani Taliban terrorists and Balochi insurgents can certainly serve an important function in disrupting part of this route from time to time, the U.S. also understands the importance of state-on-state Afghan pressure in isolating or containing Pakistan as an indirect counter to China. By itself, the Afghan dispute is troublesome because of the close historical and ethnic ties between the two neighborly states. But even more worrying is the fact that India, Pakistan's hated foe and China's continental competitor, is set to increase its ties with Kabul partly out of self-interested economic gain, but also as a geostrategic flanking maneuver against Islamabad. The Pakistani authorities are aware of the stratagem, and some commentators suspect India of secretly egging Pakistan on in the latest shootout. And with New Delhi slated to have indirect intermodal access to the landlocked state via the development of the Indian port of Chabahar, they fear that their country might soon be surrounded by hostile Indian influence. This is important because if India disrupts the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor out of its so-called national security considerations in countering Pakistan, then it also sabotages China's ambitions as well, which, when considering New Delhi's very warm ties with Washington lately, might actually have been the main target all along. Our runner-up is the incident between Chinese fishermen and the Indonesian Navy, and why the U.S. would be overjoyed if Beijing and Jakarta had a falling out. For the third time in 3 months, the Indonesian Navy has had problems with Chinese fishermen near the Natuna Islands, a small chain of territory in the northwest of Borneo and abutting the southwestern reaches of the South China Sea. It's best to open up a map and Google these islands if you don't already know where they are. But the reason that the Chinese fishermen were nearby is because Beijing claims the neighboring water as its sovereign territory as part of the Nine Dash Line. I'm not going to get into the history of this policy because I just don't have the time. But why it's relevant to this situation is because China recognized Indonesian sovereignty over these islands last November, but has been mum on Jakarta's claimed exclusive economic zone there that supposedly overlaps with Beijing's nine-dash line. This might one day become an issue between them, and it looks like it's already creeping up as an item on their bilateral itinerary. But one of the reasons why both sides are reluctant to press their claims is because China is Indonesia's largest trading partner, and the two states have generally had very positive relations since the end of the Cold War, and especially in the last decade. Both understand the importance of the other. China sees Indonesia as a valuable market and a geostrategic gatekeeper in connecting the Pacific and Indian Oceans, and Indonesia sees China as a reliable, no-strings-attached economic partner with heavy global sway. What happened was likely a misunderstanding, since it's doubtful that either side would have wanted to escalate this unresolved issue with the other, especially seeing the immense strategic relations that are at stake. Things like this happen when maritime territory is not fully delineated, and there are still outstanding uncertainties over who precisely has sovereignty over what. But what's important isn't so much that this latest incident happened, but how it eventually resolves itself. Both sides are justifying their positions and aren't apologizing, though they're still being pretty diplomatic about it, at least for now. What worries me, though, is the U.S.'s stake in all this, since it's obvious that Washington wants to disrupt relations between Beijing and Jakarta and pull Indonesia into the unipolar TPP orbit, which is only possible if a crisis breaks out between the two Asian powers. We can't know for certain, but it's a safe and reasonable guess that the U.S. is leaning on its Indonesian partners to take a more publicly assertive and militant stance against China and its fishermen. I believe that the Indonesian authorities have enough common and practical sense to avoid this blatantly obvious and tempting trap. But then again, I and many others also thought that India would not fall for the China containment bait either. But look what happened. At our top spot, we've got Kurdish terrorists invading northwestern Iran and showing the world why a so-called Kurdistan is a really bad idea. Let me start off by saying that no terrorist group represents the majority sentiment of the demographic that it claims to be acting for. So in this case, I want to be explicitly clear that when I speak about Kurdish terrorists, I'm only talking about a minority percentage of this group that has garnered disproportionate attention for its activity and is capable of being manipulated by outside actors. That being said, Iran was recently victimized when Kurdish terrorists attempted to invade the country from the northern Iraqi Kurdish regional government. The so-called Party of Free Life of Kurdistan illegally crossed the border and entered into a fierce firefight with the Revolutionary Guards, with the Telegraph reporting that 12 Kurds were killed compared to 3 Iranian guardsmen. The Kurdish terrorist group was also allegedly involved in killing 2 guardsmen and an engineer last month. And it's not me who's calling these Kurds terrorists, it's Iran's official media outlets and government statements that have labeled the group that way. But wait, hold on a second. You might be thinking, aren't the Kurds the good guys, as in they're the ones fighting Daesh and only Erdogan calls them terrorists? Well, that's only part of the story, because this Kurdish terrorist group is also linked to the PKK, the group that Erdogan and the Turks are fighting against, with all of them also being connected in one way or another to the Iraqi Peshmerga and the northeast Syrian PYD that are fighting against Daesh. So yes, Kurds are in a sense good guys. But we need a qualifier statement here. Fighting against Daesh is good, but being suspected of ethnically cleansing Arab and Assyrian towns in northern Syria, like the PYD's YPG militia allegedly does, that's bad. Really bad. Just like unilaterally declaring a so-called federal state with the intent to internally partition Syria. And the Iraqi Kurds aren't much different, since they're talking about outright independence from Baghdad in the coming months. But then again, they've been saying that for a while. If we look at the rise, or what some might say, return of militant anti-government Kurdish groups in Turkey, Iraq, Syria, and now even Iran, we can see an unmistakable pattern of semi-coordinated military campaign being waged to create a so-called Kurdistan that will be carved out of these countries, relying on the positive reputation that two of these groups have for fighting Daesh as the excuse for tricking the rest of the world into supporting this. Now, before you say that Kurds got the short end of the stick with Sykes-Picot, let me remind everyone that there was never before in history any so-called Kurdistan at all. So, this historically nomadic group didn't actually lose anything during that time. What they want to do, however, is create another geopolitical Israel in the heart of the Mideast, or in other words, take parts of other people's country and make it their own, relying on international guilt to get away with it. And just like when Israel was created out of a partitioned Palestine, you know who benefits if Syria, Iraq, Iran, and even Turkey are petitioned to create Kurdistan? The United States. That's who. So guys, there you have it. That's the end of this week's Context Countdown. And like I always do, I want to thank you very, very much for tuning into my program. And I also want to welcome you to share it on social media if you can. Next week, I'll be on holidays, so you won't have another Context Countdown for 2 weeks. So I hope you guys will listen to my show again during that time. And hope you guys enjoyed it. Have a nice weekend and enjoy the next coming weeks. Bye.